Welcome to another episode of Photo Geek Weekly. We've been off for a few weeks, so we're back with episode 37 after I've been away on vacation for a little while. And I arranged this beforehand. I figured there would be some big geeky announcements over the time that that I was away to have a geek of tall stature here with me today. Steve Brazel joins me again for another great episode, or I know it will be. Steve, how you doing?
I'm good, thank you. Welcome back.
Thank you. Yeah, it was exhausting. You think, going away on vacation. Well, when you go away with family, especially with a toddler, and you're going to, my wife is originally from Bulgaria, so we go back every year to visit family and friends, and the visits are fantastic. Don't get me wrong. Like so many, glasses raised and cheers, but it's not lazing around on the beach. It's not a time, and even if you were doing that, you'd be chasing a two-year-old. So you come back and you're thinking, my goodness, I need a vacation.
But did get time to shoot, because what you've been posting has been awesome.
Yeah, and I'm glad that that I was able to go. We typically go on a road trip, and every year about four days to a week, we'll just rent a car and drive around the country and see some interesting things. If you're not familiar, Bulgaria, an Eastern European country, borders the Black Sea. It's basically four or five mountain ranges and a coastline with some nice plateaus and valleys and stuff in between. But when you're driving through the Balkan Mountains or the Rhodope Mountains specifically, it's just picturesque. It's just fantastic for photography. And so I brought along a smaller camera this year. I'm very happy that that I've got a sponsorship now with Panasonic, and they gave me a GX9 to play with as early as the winter time. And I knew right then it would be the perfect travel camera. And this is where I really put it to the test. The image that I posted recently, Steve, I think I just showed it to you before we started recording, was taken with the 12 to 32 millimeter kit lens, which is one of the least expensive lenses in their lineup, but it's light and compact.
Now, on that body, what's that equivalent to?
So the Micro Four Thirds format is going to be a 2x crop factor. Okay, so that's going to be a 24 to 64-ish. Yeah. And that, to me, I would always run around with my Canon gear with a 24 to 105. And I found that to be a very versatile lens. Although I had to send that lens away to be repaired by Canon a number of times, twice, for the same reason. Because, and this was a known issue after it happened the first time. I was in Istanbul with my wife, and we were in the Blue Mosque. And my camera was giving me an error message. Can't remember exactly what it was, but like can't communicate with lens kind of stuff. Okay, so I'm scratching my head trying to figure out what the heck is wrong. It would work fine at 24 millimeters.
I had the same issue exactly.
But at any other setting, it would give me an error. And in researching that, I found out that, like you, so many people have this same problem, where there's a ribbon cable that connects the aperture assembly to the lens mount, where it can then communicate with the camera. And at the extremes, that ribbon cable gets pinched. And after about 3 years of continuous use, it starts to snap. It starts to break. And so here I am. The only lenses that I brought with me, the 24 to 105, because that was the lens, my fisheye lens for some trick shots, and my MPE 65 millimeter super macro lens. So without the 24 to 105, I'm useless.
Yeah. And on a Canon system, and any Canon shooters out there know, on a Canon system, really, the 24 to 105 is just the perfect range for a travel lens. If you're going to put one lens on your body, the F4, 24 to 105 is a great all-around lens. And in my case, it was my first time photographing Slipknot, and I'm really excited, and I'm in the pit, and I'm taking pictures, and everything's fine, and suddenly I get the error communicating with lens. And I'm thinking, I've been at a festival all day, could be dust. I take it off, I clean the contacts. They're playing. I put it back on. I happen to have zoomed it out to 24. I take a shot. Oh, cool, that worked. It fixed it. And then, of course, I zoom, and it failed again. And a lot of people have that.
Yeah. And so my solution in the field, because I had to think up something, was to, at 24 millimeters, I still have proper control of my aperture. So I would dial in my aperture to whatever I would like it to be, let's say F8. And then I would press my depth of field preview button, which is around the base of the lens on the camera body. While depressing that button down, slightly dismount the lens, so that it's not making electrical contact to the camera anymore. The aperture blades will stay locked in place. So at that point, I can then adjust my zoom to whatever level I wanted and manually focus, being very careful not to let the lens fall off the camera body. I had to do that for 2 weeks.
Wow. Yeah. Well, and so I'm curious, you got to do a show where you review the G9.
The GX9, actually. The G9 is their powerhouse flagship photo camera. I'm using their smaller, much more compact travel camera, the GX9. And I mean, yes, Panasonic sponsors me, but I loved this camera before I signed the deal. And so right. It's one of the reasons why we have such a nice partnership now. But some of the ultraviolet fluorescent stuff that I've done lately has all been done with this camera. I mean, it's really capable for what it is in terms of size. To travel with a light camera, I'm going to take it everywhere. I'm not going to leave it at my wife's parents' apartment. I'm not going to leave it in the bottom of the stroller. You know, it's always going to be ready for the moment.
In my opinion, you're also going to enjoy your trip more. I mean, we're all photographers and we love to take pictures, but there is some enjoyment that actually leaves being able to enjoy the scenery, right? It's like if you're driving the California coast, it's beautiful, but you have to concentrate on the road. You don't get to see it the same way. Exactly. And it's the same when you're dealing with tripods and DSLRs when you're in Italy, right?
Yeah.
Whereas if you're just using your phone and an Olo clip, are you going to get the perfect shots that you really want at f2.8? No. But you might get some shots you can do magic with in Photoshop or Lightroom, and you can see it with your family.
Exactly, exactly. And so now the challenge is going through and editing all of the images that I took because the camera was so accessible. So many pictures were taken.
Uh-oh.
And you know, it's funny because people know what photos I've taken of groups and whatever. It's like, hey, where's that picture? Oh, it's coming eventually.
How many
did you take?
Do you know?
Well, see, like for one photo, I'll take five. I just hold my finger on the shutter button in case somebody's blinking, or if I'm trying to shoot at a lower ISO for better image quality, there might be some motion blur in one or two of the shots. So I would have taken around 4,000 or 5,000 photographs, but that's inflated. There might be, you know, 1,000 or so. I was bracketing some shots as well. And not all of them are going to be the best. Sometimes I'm just experimenting and finding the right angles. But I want to go back to that Canon problem for a brief moment. Because I paid to have that lens fixed, as one would, because it's still a great lens, and it was my go-to tool. 3 years later, same exact problem again. So when they replaced the ribbon, it was the exact same part known to fail in the repair. And
it didn't solve the problem?
And so it did not solve the problem.
See, I rarely use mine anymore because I've switched to the 24-70 for what I shoot.
Right. And so I raised hell with Canon and they refused to fix it at no cost. And they said, well, there's no recall on this lens. There's no service advisory on this lens. And you just have to look up 24-105 lens communication error online. Plug that into Google and you will find a whole very large crowd of people that have had the same issue. So anyhow, let's... That is my opinion of that lens. I loved it. If I look through my Lightroom category of lenses that I used on my Canon bodies, it's like, aside from my snowflake work, if I take that out of the equation, 90% of my work was done with that particular lens. But I digress. We are here to talk about some of the stories of the day. And Steve, I know we got a full plate here. So why don't we just dive into story number one? This is, while I was away, Canon and Nikon have both announced their mirrorless full-frame camera systems. And this has been talked about to death in photo blogs and other podcasts and everything. So I'm hoping that we can dive in and find some under-the-hood details that are interesting to our audience that they may not have heard of before. There's no specific link to this story because it's everywhere and there are so many sources to dive into. But just on the surface, Steve, what's your opinion of what we've seen versus all the rumors that we've been looking at for quite some time?
Wow. It's such. I'm thinking, how do I do a helicopter view of this? Because, you know, Nikon released two of them with the Z6 and the Z7, and Canon released the EOS R. My overall view is... they didn't catch the leaders in the market, mm-hmm. Which is expectable, right? I mean,
it's
their first throw at it, and let's be honest, they've got the standing to keep throwing at it, right? I don't think they caught the leaders in the market, but for their first foray into the mirrorless world, I think they did overall pretty good, both the companies. If I were going and looking for a mirrorless right now, did any of these make me immediately go, oh yeah, I don't need a Sony? No, none of them did that. But each individual camera does have some interesting points to it.
What do you think about the Nikon first?
The Nikon, what I find interesting about the Nikon is I think they did a really neat thing with the Z6 and the Z7. They differentiated them very, very well. First of all, the Z6 is 24.5 megapixels. The Z7 is 45 megapixels. And for reference, the Canon EOS R is almost dead in between at 30.3. They decided to go more the low and high resolution type thing. But what I like about Nikon is Nikon put in-camera stabilization, so on-sensor stabilization. And that's going to make a lot of people very happy. The other thing they did right, which I just don't understand with Canon what they did, but the Nikon is, at least the Z7, is 9 frames per second. For a 45 megapixel body, that's nice. And that's whether you're doing single shot or continuous.
Right.
The Z6 is, I think it was 12 frames per second, solid across the board. I think that's a great move on their part. That's respectable. I think it's going to have them competing. Canon on that area, for example, screwed up.
Yeah. Especially, again, it's an initial offering. So who knows if Canon is going to come out with a product at a higher or lower point than this in terms of price and value and quality. It kind of makes sense what Nikon did, having two products to fit the different niches of the market. And Canon is, at least right now, only starting with the one. There's going to be a ton of announcements between now and Photokina. So who knows what
but,
we
but
will
can
see.
You make a guess for me? I'm curious what you think of this. When I first saw this, I really actually, the first thought that hit me was, I want to know Don's explanation for this. Canon is 8 frames per second, and that's what everybody's seeing, but it isn't. It's 8 frames a second on AFS, which is autofocus single shot. AFC, continuous autofocus, it's only 5 frames per second on a mirrorless body. And I don't understand why they made that choice.
So my guess, and I have no inside knowledge and I'm not a camera engineer, but, you don't have a separate sensor detecting autofocus. It is the same sensor recording the image as is using autofocus. They've got their dual pixel autofocus rolled into the EOS R. And so...
Which is amazing.
There's no question about that. But if the sensor itself is so busy and the processor behind it is so busy just recording and interpreting information. One of the things that they talked about in this white paper that Canon put out, what were they referring it to? I'm just looking through it right now. The digital lens optimizer system, which they talked about, they can figure out exactly what the aperture is on the particular camera, what the pixel pitch is, of course, of that camera would be known to the camera, and they can calculate the diffraction. And then on the fly, if this feature is turned on, they can apply certain processing to the file to overcome certain levels of diffraction in processing, different levels of sharpening based on how much diffraction would be known to it, or different lens aberrations if you're shooting wide open. And there's a lot of processing overhead that's going to be required on the fly if these features are turned on.
But so, can't you make the assumption Nikon is doing the same thing and still getting 9 and 12 frames per second across the board?
Nikon did not state something as elaborate as this system from Canon here. So,
okay, so it could be a processing overhead.
I think it's a processing thing where the sensor is otherwise busy doing other things.
Right.
Unless you have a faster processor or a second processor within the same system, so it's constantly kind of shotgunning the information, you know, one processor handles one shot and then in between the interim, a second processor handles the next one and so on and so forth. I don't know how that exactly works, although I know that they've used dual processors in many of their cameras in the past. What was really interesting, I want to go back to Nikon for a moment. You mentioned the in-body image stabilizer. There was an interview with one of their executives, and it said they were asking about possibly a combination between the lens VR versus the in-camera VR, as Nikon calls vibration reduction.
Right.
And they said it will never be more than five stops, which to me raised a question. It's like, well, if it can do like, say, four or five stops in camera and like maybe five stops on a really good VR lens, why will it never exceed five stops in total? And it means that they might not be used in tandem, at least not yet with their initial products. And to me, that is kind of a missed boat. You do get vibration reduction on lenses that would otherwise not support it. So that's always a wonderful asset.
Well, and the Canon lenses, the new Canon lenses are five stops of IS.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And
that's on lens, not on body.
And so there is going to be, if you remember the Canon 100 millimeter macro L lens that they rolled out a while ago, mm-hmm. They claimed some advantages in the image stabilizer that they had put into that lens. For macro photography specifically, it wasn't just the pitch, yaw, and roll, but it was also a horizontal and vertical shift that it was able to compensate for within that specific lens, because that could be an advantage in the macro photography world. Well, now that up, down, left, and right can be handled by the sensor on any lens, where the pitch, yaw, and roll would be handled by the lens itself. Right. And so that simplifies the equation in terms of making a less expensive lens while adding in that extra image stabilization into the camera body. So
you're not, it's not additive of full IS here and full IS here. They're splitting and sharing the load.
I think so.
Of a five-stop IS, which to me makes sense. But, you know, you asked my opinion about the Nikon, and there's one other thing about the Nikon that surprised me. It's -3 EV. And I don't – almost any DSLR does -3 EV. That's no big leap. You had this chance to go out there and do really, really great. It's 493 AF points at -3 EV. And I'm curious why they didn't try to improve that autofocus in low light.
I don't know. Again, it's all the sensor that's handling everything. You don't have a separate autofocus sensor that can be finely tuned. And so you're trying, again, first throw. How much of it can you put in there perfectly? Sony, they're like the old veterans of this now. And if you look and you compare to what Sony currently has on the market, and I'm sure one of the reasons why Sony hasn't rolled out an A7S III is because they wanted to see what Canon and Nikon were going to bring right. to the table to kind of smash them down and say, all right, you know, we're putting the hammer down. This is what we're going to offer. And then it's going to be a scramble to catch up. And I love that scramble. Don't get me wrong, because the photographers benefit when these companies are spending above and beyond in their research and development. But, you know, it's interesting.
But it does... It does, though, tell you what you just said about Sony is actually a really interesting point. It kind of tells you where each company's focus is at, right? Nikon, even though Canon's always been considered the video company for SLRs, Nikon outdid the Canon on the video on these bodies. The Canon mm-hmm. is being reported to still have rolling shutter problems and a bunch of other things. And Sony is holding back, I think, any other upgrades, and they've been releasing on a mad schedule, right? I think they wanted to see what these companies did. Clearly, Nikon put the attention to video, maybe to compete with Canon, whereas Canon on this AF really stepped up. This to me, when I looked at the notes, and the one thing nobody was originally mentioning in the first, you know, comments on this, it's -6 EV, not -3, -6. That's seeing in the dark, literally, at that point. In fact, the metering only does -3, but the AF is -6. And there's 5,655 selectable AF points.
I think we should stop counting them at this point. I think that those numbers are now meaningless. And it becomes the useful, the practicality of what that represents. So if the next camera has 75,
right, there is a point where it's overkill.
It is, but it's if I had fewer of them that were more effective and better, if I could cut that number in half and have them function better, would I be happy? I would be very happy because I don't need that many of them. But I think it's just inherent to exactly how the autofocus is functioning. It's fundamental to the sensor. You can add in more if you want. I mean, it's not going to deteriorate the image quality in any way. It's just now all part and parcel to that same
I think it does matter, and I'll tell you why. When you're doing, these cameras have, for example, eye detection.
Yep.
Right? Eyes are moving quickly. It's obviously catching. Eye detection works by catching, you know, the known shapes of eyes, you know, iris versus white around it. It detects all of that. The more points you have that you can assign to patterning a moving eye, the better you're going to be. Now, reports are that the Canon works, but that you have to be closer, for example, to the subject than the Sony is what I've been reading from people who try.
Okay, but you said something very interesting there. You have to detect the pattern of a moving eye. That's not the autofocus that's detecting that. Autofocus will detect whether something is in focus. It won't detect what it is. And so detecting—
Well, yeah, but it works in conjunction. Once you detect what it is, the points have to choose it and focus on it.
Of course. But once you can detect what it is, an autofocus point is kind of moot because you know where it is. You know exactly where it is. And you can have 10,000 points. You could have 50,000 points. You could have a point for every pixel on the sensor. It's going to find it. It knows where it is. And so the fact that you have the number of these as a marketing term, I think that if it can detect, if the artificial intelligence algorithms within the camera can figure out where an eye is, then by that virtue, it can be focused on.
I'll go with you, but you still have to, detecting shape is different than detecting contrast.
Yep.
For the point of focus. So the two work in tandem, but
I'll give you that.
The bottom line is, I guess my question to you is, if you were looking at the two released Canons, I mean the two released Nikons and the new release Canons, and you were going, understanding we've already got other mirrorless, you know, on the market, right? We've got the Olympuses and we've got the Sonys and whatever. If you today were looking for a mirrorless camera, forgetting your Panasonic sponsorship for a minute, of the three that are out there, the big names, what would you pick?
The answer came when I read Canon's white paper. And if anybody is a current Canon shooter, this is a document that you should read. I will be putting it in the show notes with regards to this first story. I'm just going to go over a few quick points within this to illustrate what it's about. Section 3 says the limitations of the current EOS system. And I'm going to quote here because I think this is really important what Canon is talking about. They say, assessing the current EOS system in the context of future considerations exposes some limitations as follows. Number one, insufficient flexibilities in mount diameter and back focus distance to accommodate all of the increasingly diverse requirements in zoom and prime lenses. Number two, limited speed of the electronic communication between the lens and the camera. The EOS system came out in 1987, and I'm sure they're taking baggage along with them as they
go. And that's part of the new, now it's a 12-pin system. That's part of what that is.
Right. And so there's a different protocol, I'm sure. Even if it was 8 pins, they can make a faster protocol into that, but they have to get rid of their old baggage. They have to start fresh.
Right.
Point number three, limited electronic channels between lens and camera to accommodate new operational aspirations. So it's not just autofocus and setting the aperture. A lot of the new lenses for Canon, they have control rings on the lens that can be configured to do a number of different functions based on custom functions configured by the camera. And number four, constraints in sensor-based autofocus operational capabilities. What this is saying is it saying there are so many limitations with our current EF system that we cannot overcome unless we completely switch to a new system. And that's big. I mean, I'm reading between the lines to say that. But if I, this document is 40 pages. If I just go to the very end, there was a point in there where they issue a lot of the values of the new mount and everything that it's capable of. Here's the synopsis of everything. They say significantly shortening the distance, the flange distance, would yield immediate new degrees of freedom in optical design. And right. What happens is when you can make the rear element not only closer to the sensor, but bigger.
You can make it bigger because it's closer.
Exactly. And so if it's bigger, then light doesn't have to bend as far afield. And when light is bending to a greater degree, that's where a lot of issues with chromatic aberration come in. So if the light doesn't have to bend so far from that rear element to hit the sensor or the film plane, now we're all sensor in this case, in this new mount, but then your optical system can be designed much more simply to get exactly the same optical performance. Or you can spend as much time in research and development and have a lens that costs the same as we have now, and the optical performance is markedly improved. And so that you can't simply do with the old lens mount, and this is the way forward. They continue to say, but this of necessity would have to be balanced with the rigidity of the new mount, ease of attaching and detaching lenses, durability, dust, drip resistance. You know, you can't sacrifice any of that. You know, right. You want to have the same
and this
quality.
Camera is sealed, by the way. So
exactly. The in-depth design reviews within Canon yielded that the new RF lens mount, preserving the 54 millimeter inner diameter while significantly shortening the flange back to 20 millimeters. Nikon's is even shorter than that. I think they're at 16. Positioning of the larger diameter lens elements much closer to the image sensor would support an important enhancement in image quality. So they're saying effectively that this is the way forward. I can say one other statement in here, and they say in the context of the digital camera, Moore's law remains amazingly resilient from its first promulgation. That's an interesting word. At the end of the 1970s, for those that don't know, Moore's law is originally it was to say every year or so transistors will double in the number, or the processors will double in the number of transistors that they have.
Processing power will double every.
I think it was originally the number of transistors, and then processing power is our current interpretation, and it might be 18 months, not every 12. But the same, it's an exponential growth within processing power is what we're getting to. It seems there's no end in sight. As a consequence, digital camera processing has benefited to an extraordinary level, as testified by the huge range available today, their continuing performance elevations, and their steady decrease in size and weight. It must be anticipated that this will continue. Canon is throwing everything into this.
Well, and what's interesting to me is, and I didn't know about this document. You just told me today about the release of this document. But I find it refreshing and borderline gutsy for them to so transparently and blatantly put their thinking out there in this paper.
If you read this, and that's why I recommend anybody that's a current Canon user, read this document, because they are effectively saying the EOS system is on life support, or the EF system is on life support.
Well, but they're also letting you know we have a plan, and they're laying their plan out.
Exactly.
Which is interesting, which... Again, though, that still brings into question a lot of what they did on this body.
But. Right. And my guess, and this is a wild guess. I don't know no inside knowledge here. I just read this document and it came to mind. Their next release of a flagship 1D body will be their last best swan song on the EF mount.
I don't doubt it. I think they'll do one more top of the line. I think they'll do another 5 series. But other than that, I think they're not looking at, like many people are, mirrorless being a transitionary period. I think that they're clearly wanting to go all in on, okay, it's time to cut bait.
Yep.
And let's just jump. And they're announcing it out loud, which is wild. Before we move on from this story, though, there are a couple of things that I think need to be mentioned. First of all, the multi-function touch bar that's on the Canon, which is similar to like what you might get on the MacBook Pros with touch bar. It's programmable. Mm-hmm. I think that's interesting, has a lot of potential. You mentioned that they released 4 new lenses, 3 of which are L glass. They have a programmable ring on the lens that can be set up to do shutter or ISO. I also think that's really, really a cool idea.
And I love the fact that the mounts, or the adapter mounts that they have to add EF lenses, one of those mounts has that same ring built into the adapter.
Yep. So you can put your normal EF glass on and get that feature.
Yep.
They have another one that has drop-in filters,
oh,
too,
which is
interesting.
Oh, I think that's just marvelous. I would jump on board to that with any system because...
They put thought into it.
Well, yeah, they did. And what if you have the third-party manufacturers that, you know, they make the little drop-in filters for NDs or infrared or anything else, especially on lenses that you can't use a standard filter for, like a fisheye lens or an ultra-wide angle. There's huge contraptions from the big filter manufacturers to try and make something work with that. But the real answer is putting it on a mirrorless camera body with the mount adapter that has a filter you can drop in behind.
Oh, and regardless of millimeter of the lens, it's one filter
exactly
for all your lenses.
Yeah. Now, to be fair, some wide-angle lenses have a little gel drop-in slot in the back of them that you can use, but you can't use that with a polarizing filter. You can't use that with the majority. Like maybe a neutral density filter can fit in there, but it's pretty limited in its use, and this becomes much more universal. And so I think that just by the looks at it, Canon is throwing so much into this in terms of getting people to buy this new EOS R body and still have the full functionality of all of their EF lenses, but then to start buy into the RF lenses, which, you know, they should have chosen a different letter for that. It makes me think of wireless controlled stuff.
Yeah, it's kind of a bizarre. Also, we should point out one of the other notes that I think got lost in everything I read online is, according to Canon, no matter which adapter ring you use, the regular one, the one with the control ring, or the one with the drop-in filter, they're saying you can use your existing current lenses with no quality loss.
Which would make sense because there's no optics involved, right? Because it's just setting the flange distance to a longer point.
Yeah, that's all it is.
Right. So, yeah, I mean, you wouldn't notice any quality difference. If you are using any adapter that has optics involved, like if you were to use a Canon FD lens onto an EF mount, then you would have to have optics within that mount. Otherwise, you lose infinity focus and the quality falls apart.
So video is the one thing I mentioned at the beginning where I thought Nikon clearly beat the Canon. And so there's just a couple of notes on the video end to me. Sony and Nikon are both full sensor on 4K. The Canon is staying with this 1.7 crop factor.
That sucks.
Which is, everybody's going to hate. Now, Canon said, they actually gave a reason that they did that. It's also 30 frames a second, by the way. Canon said that it's to avoid heat issues, and their phrasing was, you could shoot all day in the desert without an overheating issue. Which, okay, I don't know how many people are going to go to Death Valley with their Canon mirrorless and shoot 4K, but still, most video producers are going to not like that. Canon is 60 frames a second at 1080p. All the others are 120 frames a second. And this one isn't so much a critique or anything. It's just something you're going to see different numbers out there. Canon's paperwork says 10-bit 422 through the HDMI out. But I only found one or two places where they specifically stated it's 422 8-bit internally.
Right. And so you would need an external recorder in order to get the 10-bit output.
To get the 10-bit. So
again,
if you want that dynamic range, you've got to add.
Exactly. And we don't have these cameras in hands. And sometimes these specs will change based on market disruptions. And that might be even just a firmware fix that can add that depending on the speed of the memory cards that are applied. But we kind of have to read the tea leaves here a little bit and figure out exactly what the final product is going to be. There is more detail at this stage of the game than I expected to see, especially from Canon being very, very transparent. I was for many years a Canon shooter. I still have all of my Canon gear. After reading this document, I now have to sell it quickly because I've got a feeling that the EF stuff is going to depreciate in value
very quickly,
faster than many people are going to realize.
Yeah, and I'm glad I bought the 5D4 now and not spent the money on the 1DX Mark II. There's three other things on this Canon, at least, that were intriguing to me. One, it uses the same battery. And a lot of people are saying, oh, it's just a mirrorless 5D4. It's not a mirrorless 5D4, but it does use the same battery. it has a full-size DSLR grip, basically, as opposed to one of my problems with a lot of the mirrorless is I don't feel comfortable holding them. The bodies feel too small in my hand. They do have a silent shutter, but it only works in single shot for now. That will be upgraded through firmware later. And the one thing to me, at least it's an SD card slot, which almost anybody has SD cards, but there's only one slot.
Yeah. And the SD format is an evolving standard. I mean, it's got umpteen levels of backwards compatibility. And I've got a 128 gigabyte SD card. And I think, was it Toshiba or somebody else announced 256 gigabyte lightning fast cards?
Yep.
And so, yeah, you know what? You want to put all your eggs in one basket? I don't really have an issue with modern memory cards. I haven't had any with modern memory cards, knock on wood. But you only have the one option. And so for those people that are paranoid, rightly so in some cases, that you're shooting mission critical work that cannot be repeated, you want to be recording to two cards at the same time. Yeah. And if you don't have the ability,
that will hurt this, I think, with the professional market, at least the Canon one. This is why I think, and I'm a Canon shooter, and it sounds like I'm really ripping this Canon. I don't mean it that way. This camera is intriguing to me. I actually am really excited to try one and see what I like and dislike about it shooting it. I'm going off of what I've read and other people that have touched it. It just seems to me in the first foray, if you're going to try and make a mark on your first foray, we need to really clearly point out those areas that were odd choices when you have so much competition already in the field. Example, it has a USB port on the Canon RF. That can be used for charging, but it can't use a normal USB charger. You have to use the proprietary Canon power adapter. They stayed with something. This is my biggest complaint with my 5D4. In the Nikon world, and I don't know about Panasonic or Sony, but in the Nikon world, when you use, for example, spot metering, if you move your focus point around the screen, the spot that it's metering off of follows the focus point. And that happens on multiple Nikon bodies. On Canon, it's only the 1D series. The 5.4, I could move my focus point all the way up and all the way to the right and put it on a singer on a stage that's lit with a spotlight. But the center focus point is hovering over a black area of the stage. My spot meter stays at the center. And they did the same thing on this camera from what I've been able to find. AF point linked spot metering is not provided.
Well, that means to me that they're doing...
And that's software that could have been done.
Right, but that means this is feature differentiation, right? They want to have a higher end product that has that feature so that you buy that one instead of this one. And while that does seem selfish in some ways, that's business. I mean, Canon has done this to a fault with many cameras because they could have put more into it and they deliberately did not. Classic example.
They're handicapping their own hardware.
Well, classic example is the 1DX and the 1DC. Functionally the same camera. They say that they did better heat dissipation in the 1DC, but they refused to put out over the air user downloadable and upgradable firmware updates to the 1DC because they know it's exactly the same hardware and somebody would reverse engineer the 4K features of that, put it on the original 1DX, they wouldn't be very happy with that. Canon has done this. I'm sure every other manufacturer has, but what that might hint at is that Canon has a higher end product that is going to be riding the coattails of this one that we might be seeing soon too. If Nikon came out with two bodies, it's not a complete unknown thing to think Canon was going to be doing the same. They just didn't announce them at the same time.
Agreed. I just think there's certain features that are not good choices for handicapping for pushing people to a higher body. And I think spot metering should be spot metering always on the focus point. It's weird choices to me from a company that is coming up in the behind on this market.
And again, total guess, but it might have something to do with a patent that Nikon holds that Canon would have to license, which raises the cost of the product.
Ooh. Good point. I never thought about that.
So, I mean, there's tons of different facets that we can look at and kind of see a shimmer of information here and there. And I don't know. I just talking out of my butt when it comes to those kinds of ideas. But yeah, the end consumer hurts because of it. And so we play this game constantly as we move forward. Speaking of patents, if we look back to older technology, I'm talking real old. I'm talking this stuff couldn't be patented because it was top secret. There was a story that I kind of found as a fun juxtaposition to all the modern stuff that we typically talk about on this podcast. And a little breather before we get back into some of the modern stuff, an article on Petapixel. And I hope you watch this little video, Steve. It's going to be in the show notes too, on how these former Kodak engineers, it might be a grandiose statement, but how they helped prevent World War III. And this is the story of the development of the KH-7 Gambit reconnaissance satellite. It was used from 1963 until 1967, but the engineering started way back in 1958. Of course, this predates the moon landings, and the U.S. government needed a way to spy on Soviet missile and military operations. And so this was just a really fun look back at how people solved problems with technology without computers, just human ingenuity, mechanics, and old school just elbow grease. What did you think about this?
This one, when you put this in the show notes and I went looking it up, it's a 4-minute video from CNN actually on these guys where they talk about their jobs. And it's really kind of, it takes you back. You mentioned the moon landing. It takes you back, though, to that kind of era where much of our technology was being developed as a race against other countries that we were competing with. And in this case, where they're trying to understand what's happening at Soviet nuclear sites and with their missile installations, and they needed to be able to see these things. So they go to Kodak. The Kodak guys did not know. They knew they were developing cameras. They actually had no idea what their camera was being used for. It was for them. It was actually a division of Kodak. What that was, the military division of Kodak,
research and engineering. Yeah,
research and engineering. But they didn't know what their inventions were used for. It was just turned over to the military. And think about the time frame here. Right, started like in the late 50s, actually utilized for 4 years from 63 to 67, and in those days could reveal subjects smaller than a foot in size.
Now, they still, it is, it's still classified today exactly what the resolution of this camera system was. And to me, that's just bizarre. I mean, clearly, we're beyond that now. Just let us know. But now they still, for whatever reason, want to keep that classified.
But imagine if in 63 to 67, Kodak invented something that could, from a satellite, identify an object less than a foot wide.
Yeah.
And go back to Moore's Law.
Exactly. Where are we today?
And where, oh my God.
You can see the screen on my phone if I'm walking out in sunlight.
It's fascinating to me. It really makes you realize how handicapped Google Earth is, right?
Yeah.
Because we know we can get closer, 3D view on your house. These people, by the way, still meet for lunch. That was interesting. But did you see the part about how they got the, because think about it. It's 1963 to 67. It's not digital being sent over communications. It's actual film.
So they load up unexposed film into the satellite, a pre-described amount per device. And there were multiple launches of these satellites. They would only have one retrieval mechanism per satellite. So it would shoot its payload, which to me is even bizarre because that's just pure math to figure out where that satellite is going to be. There's no live view. There's no say, okay, we're over the right spot now. We've got confirmation and fire. It's pre-programmed, and everything has to be exact for it to be pointing at exactly what it needs to shoot. And I'm sure some of the engineers saying or listening to this might say, yeah, you know what? It is just pure math. There's just a lot of it, but if you get it right, you get it right. And I get that, but it's still such a foreign thing for me. And so you shoot the film and mission accomplished. How do you get that back? Because this is not like you can scan it and send it back to Earth like the Voyager space probes did. You have to physically drop the film in a retrieval mechanism back down to Earth. Now,
which was a mechanism with a parachute.
A mechanism with a parachute that was intended to be intercepted by an aircraft midair.
a giant aircraft, a C-130.
Yeah, we're not talking like a little biplane here. And I don't know if it was specifically on this one, if they used the same mechanism, but on the earlier Corona satellites, which were also spy satellites, it kind of got me through a Wikipedia rabbit hole. They had a salt plug in the bottom of the retrieval mechanism so that if it dropped into the ocean, after 2 days of sitting there, the salt would dissolve and seawater would fill the film canister and destroy it. Because if it was not picked up by the air, they did not want it to end up into the enemy's hands. They thought of everything for this stuff.
Well, and one of the things that was in the video, and I'm trying to remember the details of it in my head now, and I'm failing at it, and I didn't put it in my notes, but there was some, one of the engineers was talking about, they had a problem to solve because of the fact that they're shooting from a satellite. And they're trying to get these pictures the way that they need them. And they had two options, and that was move the camera, but they couldn't. So they devised a system to move the film.
This is the world's first in-body image stabilization.
Exactly.
So the satellite is moving around the Earth. The Earth is spinning. There's so much motion. And if you've got a fairly extreme telephoto lens that is able to pick up a building down on the Earth's surface, there's going to be a ton of motion there. So how do you correct for that? Well, you physically move the film in concert with that same motion in order to get the results that you're after.
And look at them. There's a picture in this Petapixel article that's sharper than what I take handheld.
Yeah, yeah. And it's interesting, too. They say that it had a stereo strip camera so that along one strip of a landscape, you would have the ability to do stereoscopic 3D imagery, which would tell you the height and more of the geometry of subjects around and not just a flat image. People are sitting down with pen and paper in 1958, jotting down everything that this thing needs to do, having no idea how it's going to be used. And it was a huge success within a very short period of time. I like to geek out over this stuff. There's not really much more to discuss than the success.
But there is one interesting thought that just hit me, and that is, imagine if this wasn't top secret. Imagine back then if some of this technology that they had invented specifically for military use could have made it into mainstream R&D back in the 60s and early 70s, where we might be now. Now, I'm sure some of it was being designed in parallel by commercial companies, but still, the budget that they had for the military during the Cold War, they had the tools to develop this, and had that been available then, we might even be farther ahead.
Yeah, this came in, I forget the exact stats, but it was like $8.6 billion in today's dollars, if you equate that. And you know, that seems like a lot of money, but I know the U.S. spends a heck of a lot more than that on their defense budget today. So imagine what the possibilities are. And we've got another story coming up at the very end for what possibilities may be with new tech. But before we get there, another announcement that's probably not going to be talked about as heavily as the Canon and Nikon stuff is Phase One has just unveiled their 151 megapixel XF IQ4 camera system. 151 megapixel. I just had to repeat that. It's got to sink in. If you're not familiar with the medium format system, it usually is modular. And so this is also a modular system. You've got the digital back, which is the sensor and all the components, the screen and the ports and everything. That is separate from the camera body, which is also separate from the type of viewfinder you want to use. And it's also separate from the lens. So you've got at least four separate components that you combine together. If you want to upgrade just the sensor and those components, you can choose to do that. But if you're buying into this from the ground up, it's going to set you back a little bit more than our last automobile cost us at about $55,000 for their high-end model. Now, that's not for everybody, of course, but the fact that this technology exists and it's a polished product with tons of lenses and accessories and stuff available for the system, it just doesn't show up out of nowhere. I had to look back and see how fast this has evolved, because I remember even a few years ago, like I got my Canon, was it the 5D Mark II? And it was a 21 megapixel camera. And that was in the end of 2008, I think. And I remember using it in early 2009. At that time, the medium format stuff, they were just pushing out, and their flagship stuff was 60 megapixels at probably an obscene price. But then it would be like a 3 or 4 year gap before they had any new products on the market. Last year, Steve, I'm sure you're familiar with the document that I'm referring to, their Wikipedia page. Last year, they had a 100 megapixel camera body that really just blew everything out of the water. We might have even talked about it on this podcast. 15 stop dynamic range. One of the interesting things about these cameras are their RAW files are 16-bit RAW files, not 14-bit, which is the standard consumer cameras. Even the highest end flagship products are 14-bit RAW files.
14, right.
So there's a... It doesn't sound like a lot, but those extra 2 bits gives you a lot of additional information. And now in 2018, we're not even at the end of the year yet, and they've got 151 megapixel camera body that I didn't think that the industry garnered enough sales to have a product cycle iteration period this fast.
Well, this to me is an odd thing. There is a fairly large market for medium format, but when you start thinking about the photographers that actually do medium format, it's usually high end commercial photographers doing magazine shoots, fashion, entertainment, high end headshot stuff like a Peter Hurley. It's a niche market, but it's not a small market. But when you start talking, they actually released, by the way, 3 cameras. They did update the 100 megapixel camera. They released 2 different bodies at 150 megapixels. So the price range is like $48,000.
Yeah, one is a black and white model. And one is color. The black and white one
right.
will go up to an ISO of 102,400. Of course, you're probably not going to want to use it at that level. But that's 2 stops higher than the color image, the color sensor version.
But still, that almost accentuates my point, which is when you release a 150 megapixel camera that costs $50,000+, you have a very small market for
and
that.
Especially if the market is saturated by people that bought the one you put out last year.
That's 100 megapapixels and probably more than they
and
need.
And was probably around the same price. You're not going to upgrade
exactly.
that on a yearly basis.
Well, no, because you got a 4-year loan.
Yeah.
You've got a mortgage on it. But when I first saw this at 150 megapixels, my thought was, okay, this is almost more proof of concept, which is easy for a medium format company like Phase to do, because really you're dealing with a back, not a whole camera, like we talked about. It's a modular system. But when you release a color in a black and white, what that tells me is, no, this is not a proof of concept. You believe that there is a market for 150 megapixel black and white only, because otherwise you wouldn't do it. You've also put in this camera Capture One Inside, which is a brand new system where the Capture One software for editing to give you better JPEG previews, processing, they say it actually gives you better frame rates. I'm not sure how, but it gives you other tools. Capture One is basically built into these for you to do your editing. And it's got everything that you need to directly interface with a NAS, which you're going to need to because the file sizes are ridiculous. But hard drives, NAS, network solutions, whatever, you can directly interface with.
You know what was interesting? I'm looking at the stats here, and it just jumped up at me. Their 2017 models featured a FireWire 800 port.
Oh, I didn't. Seriously?
Yeah. 2017. I'm guessing they had their old workflow, their older models, like back in 2007, 2009, even earlier than that, were all FireWire only. And in 2011, they introduced USB. But I guess to satisfy the people that were still holding on to FireWire 800 hardware, their 2017 models had that port.
See, this one is... that is just bizarre.
The new one is USB-C. Of course, it's got Ethernet and Wi-Fi, they've ditched the...
Well, the Ethernet is interesting. That's that, because this is the type of photographer that would tether.
Right, and I've got an Ethernet port on my 1DX Mark II. I mean, that's rolled into that camera too. I've never used it, mind you, but...
Yeah, but can you imagine tethering 150 megapixel pictures over Wi-Fi?
Yeah, that would not be fun.
No, but over Ethernet, now you've got, I didn't see if this is 10/100 or if it's gigabit. I'm assuming it's gigabit. that would make tethering a body like this practical. It is SD or XQD.
And the XQD cards, I mean, they're at 400 megabytes per second, and that exceeds a gigabit per second in terms of throughput, although you are limited in the storage capacity of those cards.
So here's the big question. How many of these are they going to, how many of these do they actually think they're going
to sell? Well, and that's why I was so surprised that this is from last year to this year. The people that bought the 100 megapixel model last year, they're good. You know, maybe a three of them are going to go out and buy this new one, but it just, to me, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
I don't get it. I mean, don't misunderstand me. Would I shoot one if I had one in my hand? Oh, yeah.
Of course.
But
now, here's a theoretical.
I don't see Annie Leibovitz changing.
Right. Here's a theoretical, it could be a game changer. What if the firmware for this new camera allowed the pixel shift image resolution increase technology to be applied on a sensor that's already 151 megapixels? So Hasselblad had done this with their, I think it was a 50 megapixel medium format, and they got a 200 megapixel file out of it as a result. If you're at 150, 151, and you want to quadruple that, I mean, you are well over the half gigapixel mark. And for a lot of the people that are using these cameras in studio shooting, it's going to be a static subject, at least static enough to do that. Then you're at 600 plus megapixels.
Well, I mean, now you're getting into competing with Gigapan technology, except that Gigapan is, you know, pano. It's, you're still with a fixed lens on this thing.
Exactly. So
I don't know why you need that. I guess that's really what it comes down to, is I don't under, you can print a billboard with what we have today.
I have a print on the wall behind me. It is done with 7 megapixels worth of image data. It's an 80 by 20 print. Could it have benefited from more resolution? Maybe. But that was done with a 5D Mark II, and I just cropped away 2/3 of the image to give it a panoramic crop.
My friend Alan Hess in San Diego shoots Nikon, and he's got photos of bands that he shot at the arena that he's the house photographer at. And, you know, when you're in an arena, you've got the seats in the stadium part inside, and then you have basically walkway rings around the arena. On the walls of those, full, like whatever, 10 foot high, they've printed his photos that were taken. They're 10 foot high. They look great.
Yeah.
I don't understand. And I don't get it.
For years, I've used the 1DX Mark II. It's a 20 megapixel camera body. Very good pixels, but only 20 million of them. Now I'm using the GX9 primarily, and that's a 20 megapixel camera body as well. Would I like more? Yes. Yes, I would. You know, I borrowed the Canon 5DSR for a time, and I really enjoyed what I could do with that. But did I need it? No. I didn't need it. More is always better, so long as I don't have to completely change my workflow. Am I going to sacrifice things in the process in terms of the quality per pixel, my low light performance? I didn't find the 5DSR performed nearly as good in low light, and so I tried it, and then I moved on.
You've got the high-res Sonys. You now have a high-res mirrorless Nikon, 45 megapixels. That's half of these, and it's way less than half of 50 grand.
A third of them, yeah. Exactly. So, you know, we'll see what we can come up with in the future in terms of what gear is going to be useful to us. But who knows? The people that are doing the high-end work, maybe the people that are hiring them say, we want the best. We don't care. We want the best. We will pay for the best. You're not using the best equipment. You're not going to get hired by us. Because people with more money than sense often make statements like that. So if they say you have to have the best, then you as a professional say, okay, well, you client, you are going to have to pay me X percentage more for this gig because I have to afford the best in order for you to get it. Yeah. All right. Well, I hope they sell more than a dozen,
but I wouldn't hold my breath.
I have no idea. I have no idea what the market for this is. If anybody from Phase One wants to contact me, I would love to do an interview with you guys because this is just fascinating to get under the hood to see who buys your stuff. If you want to talk numbers, I'm sure a lot of people would at least appreciate some even vague sense of what's going on here, because to me, I'm having a hard time making sense of it. Speaking of things I'm having a hard time making sense of, Steve, Brings me to my final story. Again, this was reported by Petapixel, one of my favorite photo blogs. Scientists develop a lensless camera that uses a plate of glass from a window instead. What? So I looked at this and I'm thinking, okay, I mean, normally when you don't have a lens on the camera, you just get like maybe some vague colors and differences in brightness. It's a blob. And so a plate of glass does not a lens make. So if you were to put a plate of glass in front of your camera, you're still not going to get anything useful. It's not. It's going to do nothing, really, except if you do it sideways, apparently. Because if you attach a camera, just a raw camera sensor, on the thin edge of glass, looking into the mass of the glass itself, you're not looking through it the traditional way, you're perpendicular to that.
90 degrees to the edge of the glass.
Exactly. So, and if you're confused as to what that exactly means, take a look at the article in the show notes at photogeekweekly.com, because this is just bizarre. What the CMOS image records, and then they do a reference to what the they're shining an LED display with a bunch of different little LED lights on that can make a different pattern. And the LED object in their first example is an arrow. And the reconstruction is pretty darn accurate. And if you watch the video, these are not static objects. They're actually animated. And the animated reconstruction is really damn accurate as well. But if you see what it results from, it looks like some very poorly done refractography without a lens on the camera, just trying to muck with light, creating patterns like you might find on the bottom of a swimming pool. And then using that to recreate a scene of everything around that swimming pool. It doesn't seem possible to me. Yet, here we are.
This is so wild. So, first of all, when I first saw this headline, and I first went to the Petapixel article and saw the first photo, which is the guy with this setup, it took me a second just looking at the picture to understand what the setup was. And it wasn't until I really read the article that I understood where the camera sensor came into play here. And there's a couple things that stuck out to me. First of all, this is a quote from their goal, right? What their goal was. To develop a camera that creates photos optimized for machines to look at rather than humans. So understand that goal. That's critical to me. They're not looking to reinvent photography through the side of a piece of glass for you and I. It's all AI. They're capturing raw data. And when you look at, you made the comment of these samples where they show you what the CMOS image is, what the LED object was they projected, and what the reconstruction from AI is, which, by the way, is the one with the little guy, the stick figure, is scary to me, how accurate that is. Because when you look at the CMOS images, what it looked like to me was somebody put stain on a piece of wood and spread it around and it's still drying. I mean, it literally just looks like water spread across. It's amazing that this thing works. And okay, so the sensor, it's an off-the-shelf camera sensor, right? Just a normal camera sensor designed to...
Looks like something from a point-and-shoot or something from a Raspberry Pi.
So think about that for a minute. That sensor to get a picture is designed to use all of its surface area to capture as much light as it can. When you put that up on the side of a window glass, it's barely coming in contact with it. Not to mention the fact that the sign that they're projecting it straight through the window. You're sitting on the edge of the glass, capturing it at 90 degrees. So 99% of the light from their symbols, their LED board, pass straight through. The sensor only gets 1% of the light on only a portion of the sensor. And it works. Very low resolution. Off the shelf, but imagine if they redesigned a sensor to not be, you know, rectangular as it is, but to be very skinny and very long and cover the entire edge of a 24-inch window to capture.
I mean, I don't even think you need to do that. All you would need to do is have it be able to read a barcode or a QR code for machine reading purposes. And so all somebody would have to do, like if, example, Amazon has their new system where, I don't know if they're still doing this, but you can give people access to your house to leave the package inside your front door. Well, what if the person doing that holds the package up to your window?
Oh,
and the window itself images the barcode and unlocks the door to let somebody put the package inside. There's a lot of logistics companies that could utilize this. And like you're saying, if you could increase the resolution by making a long and skinny sensor, what if you could also, and I'm hypothesizing here, but what if modifying the glass, making the glass out of a different type of ingredient, or etching it with something, or changing its shape or molecular structure to magnify the signal, that would be just normal to us. We would look through, yeah, that still looks like a normal piece of glass, but could potentially increase the resolution of something. Then you could have security cameras on everybody's front door that could, I mean, you're not going to get a really good image of somebody, but if you could get their pupil distance, the shape of their nose, the distance between their nose and their upper lip, and the space between their ears, et cetera, that's enough to do a facial reconstruction and get a culprit for somebody that might be vandalizing your property or breaking into your house.
You could just use it for a trigger, even. It wouldn't have to recognize anything. If it saw something it knew to be a human walking in a place they shouldn't be walking, it could just set off an alarm. So now, instead of infrared, now you have, what is effectively an intelligent AI replacement for just walking across a beam.
Exactly. Yeah, it's to me, this is one of those. We also said we were talking about ideas a few episodes ago when I had you on. We were talking about a camera that would use sound to record an image, and at first, the uses were kind of limited. And then we started to talk about it. And the ideas started to really come up. And what could you possibly do with this? But what if, Steve, and you've seen this in sci-fi, and I might have actually seen some actual uses of it, although it's not practical for a lot of purposes. But you can have an LCD screen that is transparent, so that it is just like a piece of glass that has a screen overlaid onto it, and you can see through it at the same time. What if you had a camera on one edge that was able to image anything from that, and then the actual piece of glass was both a screen and a camera at the same time? This is, now you're holding up what looks like just a piece of glass with a handle, and it is a tablet.
Yeah, now you're into Minority Report. That's really where you're
exactly.
at. And again, this is completely just, this is Frankenstein from this point of view. But again,
well, when you see the laboratory setup here, this is really a hodgepodge, proof of concept. You can write a paper about it and get some interest in it. But seeing the results shocked me so much that if they can do that at this stage, more money and reiteration on this concept is going to introduce
us
to a paradigm.
We're back to Moore's Law again. It's a theme.
We are.
Because I picture this, if it can already do static and moving objects, right? I can envision that this will get to the point where it can actually sense, just like a normal camera, actual people and pictures. That the AI could be, AI right now in Google can recognize a dog in a picture. So I could fully believe that there could be a point where this would get to the level where it could reconstruct an actual photo, which then really changes security applications, monitoring applications, etc.
What if you could apply this to curved glass and just different algorithms to figure out how you interpret the pattern? Then any pair of sunglasses could actually be recording the scene of whatever they're looking at without having a separate camera module involved. What about the visor of a motorcycle helmet? The windshield of a car, right? I mean, these are all, I have no idea how it would apply to a curved piece of glass. Maybe that's not possible. I'm just thinking outside the box here and understanding what those possibilities are moving forward. forward for our future. This kind of technology, these kinds of innovations are the kind of innovations that are going to shape our society. It's not just photography at this point, because it's not designed as a photographic tool. It's designed as machine learning right now. It could have societal impacts as a secondary step. Maybe photography has an impact at some point, but it's going to impact our lives in ways that we currently cannot comprehend.
Totally agree.
Awesome. Well, now that we have set up the future for our robot overlords, we can move on and talk about some picks of the week. This was an interesting one for me because I didn't expect to do this. I was borrowing a Panasonic Leica 100 to 400 millimeter telephoto lens for a project where I was using it as a base lens for some microscope objectives, where I would attach a microscope objective to that lens. The microscope objective needed a 200 millimeter lens, and so this would fit that if I set it to the right level. And I was doing some incredibly up close microscopic photography.
As you
stuff.
Would do.
And as everyone would do. And so I still had that lens when I was going away for traveling, and you know, it was compact enough. It weighs maybe about the same as my 24-105, maybe a little bit more. But just throw that in the camera bag and see when it might come in handy. And holy heck, did that come in handy when I was traveling. Imagine having the equivalent of an 800 millimeter lens that you're casually carrying around with you. There was one moment where my wife and I were at a restaurant. We had given my 2-year-old daughter to my mother-in-law, and my wife and I were out for a bit of a quiet evening for some tapas and some drinks. And we're at this restaurant on the coast of the Black Sea in Varna, Bulgaria, that is an old ship. So it's like decked out like a pirate ship, and we're sitting on the top deck, and I look over and I see sunset. And I got the camera with me. So I just casually whip out this equivalent of an 800 millimeter lens, filling the frame with some architecture in the background and some birds all dancing around the sun. And I got a bird transiting across the sun in one of the frames, shooting rapid fire. And I was just tickled pink, put the camera back in the bag and started enjoying whatever prosciutto or whatever we had on the plate, and then carried on with the meal. It was such a casual moment to be able to photograph something so amazing. And I had used it at a sunrise photograph at a different point. I'd even used it to photograph flowers from a distance, because it has a pretty close focusing distance, and to fill the frame with some rather large roses, right, and unknown flowers, and make the background just perfect on them. It's not a cheap lens. It's about $1,500 or $1,600 US on B&H. But for the size and the capabilities that offers, I was shocked at how handy it came in as a travel landscape photographer for the few weeks that I was living that role.
I can imagine. You know, I've never really shot anything at 800 millimeters, but I can imagine times traveling for something that's not big and not heavy. It would be nice.
When I was in the Yukon the last time I was there, which was a while ago now, 2014, I had borrowed a 500 millimeter lens from a colleague of mine, Ethan Mellig, and had rented a 2x teleconverter. So I was at 1,000 millimeters worth of focal length to fill the frame with birds and wildlife and what have you. But there was one moment where the sun was setting behind some trees and the clouds were created. It looked like a forest fire, but it was just a beautiful sunset. And that was done at 1,000 millimeters. So I realized there was potential there to use super telephoto focal lengths for landscape photography and to make some magic with it. And that is so true today, especially when I've got a smaller camera. The lens has to be smaller too. And that 500 millimeter f4 lens is not, like for a full frame camera size, is not light and easy to carry around. I couldn't hike up a mountain with that. I couldn't travel across Europe with that. But with that 100 to 400, it fit in my camera bag just fine. So that is my pick of the week.
I like it.
All right. Do you have a pick of the week, Steve?
Yeah, I actually, I just used this the other day on a shoot, and I do flash very rarely. I'm a Canon shooter. I have a couple of 600 RTs, and I have a 430 EX2. Canon speed lights, but I just use them very rarely. I'm a concert shooter by design, and I don't get to use flash when I shoot. And now and then, though, I will do a a promotional shoot for a band or an artist or something like that. And that's what this actually was that I needed it for. And while the RTs are wireless, my 5D Mark IV does not have wireless built in to trigger those. I have to either use one of those flashes on top of it to send the signal, or I need a controller. And the Canon controller is just so expensive. And
what is it, like $600?
I forget. I could look it up.
It's too expensive for its own worth.
Well, put it this way, especially when you end up with the product I ended up with. And I looked all over the place. I have some inexpensive ones I bought years ago at a Calumet camera store, and it worked, but they weren't TTL. And I wanted TTL. I also wanted the ability to control multiple flashes, multiple groups, and really do it upright. So I went with the Fotix Lasso. And it's the Fotix Lasso TTL flash trigger for Canon. There's a transmitter, and then there is also a receiver. Now, my two Canon 600 RTs work with this thing straight out of the box, no receiver needed. So this will transmit the actual Canon wireless signal. But for my 430EX, which is not wireless, it's optical only, I also have the related Lasso TTL flash trigger for this. But this transmitter at B&H right now is $125.95 US. And it allows you to control up to 15 flashes in 5 groups. It's the standard wireless signal. So it's, you know, whatever, 300 and something feet. It's 2.4, 15 channels. It's set up on top, so simple and easy to operate. Again,
thank you for saying that, because I've seen some of these things that have an unwarranted number of switches, knobs, and dials. And when people bring those into my studio when I'm doing a workshop, and I can't figure it out because these things are like hieroglyphics. I mean, unless you speak the language, there's no way you're going to figure it out.
There's one brand I know people use that they ask me for help all the time. And I'm like, I'm a network engineer by trade, and I can't figure that thing out. These things make it easy to understand your ABCDE groups, to understand whether you want to do it by a manual power of, you know, a 32nd or 60, or whether or not you want to do it in stops. Whether or not you want to set it up as ratios, and it makes it all really easy. It's $126 for the transmitter.
I don't even know how they could make it, like the engineering and manufacturing of that product for that price. That just
solid as a rock too, by
me.
The way. And here's one of the other big ones that on my cheap one always bothered me is the locking foot are usually plastic, and this is metal.
Oh, nice.
It's super well built. To give you an idea, on B&H right now, it's 14 reviews, 5 stars, you know, which is not...
By the sounds of it, there should be a zero in the number of reviews on a product like this. I'm actually, if I was continuing to shoot with Canon, that would be something that I would be buying almost immediately without even thinking, because there's going to be some scenario where it will immediately pay for itself in one use.
Oh, yeah. It was a lifesaver. I was debating between that and custom molded earplugs because I'm a concert photographer, but this wireless system just made... I had a friend come down with me. I put a Westcott Octobox on a monopod with a 600 RT and put this on top of my camera. And I could very easily, as I'm walking downtown in alleyways using this softbox to try and, you know, simulate different lighting, just really was able to dial in what I needed on the fly as somebody. And this is the key part of this. I don't do flash.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not a studio shooter. So for me, on the fly, when I've got a musical artist in front of me and I don't want to look like the idiot that I actually am, this made it so easy for me to take a shot, chimp the screen, go, great, okay, thanks, make the adjustment right there on the top of my hot shoe, and just shoot.
Fantastic. I look forward to putting a link to this in the show notes. Steve, make sure you send me the exact product name in an email so that we can make sure that we share that with everybody. Because if that's useful to you, I mean, it is worth every penny. It should be worth twice the price, to be honest, and it would still get a recommendation, I'm sure.
And it's Steve, in your email already, actually.
Oh, awesome. Thank you very much. Before we sign off, tell me about Behind the Shot.
Behind the Shot is my podcast that I do that you've been on more than once, actually. And just so that you know, the last episode we did with the B, did really well, still doing really well, but at the time we released it, did amazingly well. Probably since I've relaunched my number one episode, actually. And if for the listeners, if you have not listened to that episode, I did an episode with Don in February on a snowflake image that's amazing. And then I did one when I relaunched in July. I've taken the podcast out on my own. It's at behindtheshot.tv. And basically the concept of the podcast is let's flip an interview upside down. Let's not interview the photographer to get to know about their life. Let's interview their photograph, one photograph per show usually. There's exceptions, but usually. We interview the photograph, take a look at the photograph, forensically dissect that photograph to try and better understand the photographer's mind. Why do they make the choices they do? How they end up get themselves in that situation, et cetera. And I always try and approach it from a point of view of there may be people that shoot that kind of photography. There may not be. There may not be a lot of people that go out and shoot snowflakes, but there's techniques and ideas and mental processes used in photographing snowflakes and post-processing that can apply to anybody. So again, it's at behindtheshot.tv. With the relaunch, I have both a video feed, which I highly recommend because we're talking about a photograph you need to see. But I also do have an audio feed. If you search it in a podcatcher, whatever podcasting app you use, you may see the old podcast, which is on a different network. That one isn't getting any new shows, so make sure you subscribe to the correct one. And the easiest way to do that, all the links are at behindtheshot.tv.
Exactly. And you can see that it's by Steve Brazel, if you're looking for the right one in iTunes, I believe.
It's a greenish logo, not a reddish logo, yeah.
Right. So, Steve, I'm looking forward to, and I've been listening actually to I forget his name, the guy that does the rocket photography. That was a fascinating episode.
Yeah, Eric Cooney. He's vice president at Kelby One.
Oh, that's fantastic. Glad to see people like that wearing many hats and being passionate about the work that they do. The episode with Andy Anatko was also a great dive into mobile photography and sort of the state of the union for that too, which I really would like to get him on this podcast at some point. I'll try to make that happen. But
well, you know what you should do? You should get your listeners to... hit him up. No, you'll probably end up irritating if they all hit him up on social media.
Yeah, I don't want to bug him. I don't want to bug him, but
he was very kind on my show. Took a lot of time, way longer than a standard episode, just kind of exploring mobile photography. And he's my, it's weird because I know so many people in all these industries, but I'm still a fan of some people. And from a geekdom point of view, Andy Anatko is one of those guys that I've been listening to on podcasts for years, and I'm a fan of his work. I'm a fan of his voice, the way that he speaks and writes and thinks. I would love to hear him attack geekery with you.
He has wisdom and whimsy kind of wrapped all into one pair of tactical pants.
Yeah, 5'11 tactical pants.
All right. Well, Steve, I got to ask, you know, of course, we're photographers. You know, we all wear many hats. As you said, you're an IT professional. You're a rock jock on the side. And, you know, you do concert photography and many other things. What's the next big photographic thing that you're looking forward to?
Well, I week and a half ago, I photographed Rob Zombie and Marilyn Manson, and I photographed Rob Zombie a number of times, but I'd never photographed Marilyn Manson. That was really fun. But unfortunately, 3 weeks ago yesterday, I broke a rib in jiu-jitsu. And it's amazing the ways you can feel pain from a broken rib. After walking around with two camera bodies on at Rob Zombie and Marilyn Manson, I had to cancel two shoots that I was going to do, which bummed me out. I was going to shoot Stone Temple Pilots and also photograph Alice in Chains. But coming up, System of a Down is coming up. I'm really looking forward to System of a Down and Incubus. And the big one for me is coming up later this fall, Cal Jam 18 here in Southern California. It's an all-day festival put on by the Foo Fighters. Photographing the Foo Fighters is nothing short of joyous. And there's going to be a newer band that's playing Cal Jam this year, Greta Van Fleet, that I'm a big fan of, and I'm really looking forward to photographing Greta Van Fleet.
Well, I'll be thrilled to see those images. I haven't heard of that band, but maybe I will be introduced to it by seeing your charismatic images.
The big comment
images.
Everybody makes is that they sound like Zeppelin, and they do, but yet they don't. I mean, he sounds like it's not a mimicking band. It's just the guy's voice, and he's amazing.
Zeppelin was of an era that I really quite liked in music history, because not only was the music non-repetitive in terms, like, everybody had their own style, and it was more complex, but the lyrics were more storytelling, and they were less singular. Like, every verse was distinct and separate, and there was a point of meaning behind that. Any band, regardless of who they sound like, that has those qualities will win me over.
Yeah, and seriously, if anybody out there likes Zeppelin, go check out Greta Van Fleet. The entire album, it's available streaming everywhere. The entire album is really good, and I have a favor to ask, and I understand if you say no on the air even, but my son released an EP. So may I mention his?
Yes, please.
Okay, so my son is in San Diego, and he has a San Diego-based band called Pocket Hole. And they've released their EP. It's six songs, I forget now. But it's available on all the streaming services, Spotify, iTunes. It's on Bandcamp. And please check it out. If you like it, share it. My wife and I look at each other, and you're a parent, you know what I mean. But we look at each other and say, okay, can we really say what we're about to say, removing the fact that we are his parents and proud of him, and just judge it based on the fact of music? And in my case, I believe I can, because I've got 40 years in radio. I've listened to hits, and I've had to play on the air songs that were horrible. And from a completely objective point of view, I actually really dig the music. So
awesome.
Pocket Hole is the name of the band.
Well, make sure again you send me a link to that, and I will put it in the show notes for this episode at the very bottom, because that is something that, hey, I don't know what people are into outside of photography. This is a photo podcast, but you bridged into music, and here we are. Anybody that loves new music and discovering new people, they would enjoy that. So, Steve, thank you so much for being on another episode of Photo Geek Weekly. You can find Steve at behindtheshot.tv, also at stevebrazel.com, I believe. And that's like Brazil with two L's when you're trying to spell it. And I got to have you back on more often, because these discussions get so in-depth and in detail, you don't miss a beat. And I need that out of a co-host, because I can carry the conversation at some point, but you add so much to the discussion that it's just a nice banter back and forth. So again, thank you.
You are way too kind, sir, but I will do this anytime, because there's very few people that I can talk this detailed about a subject with, and it's a joy.
All right. And one final note before you stop listening. I just got a note just right now from DHL Express that my red Hydrogen One phone is shipping to me and is arriving tomorrow. So the next episode of
You've
Photo
been
Geek
telling
Weekly,
me about this phone for a year, it feels like.
I get
finally
it tomorrow.
I'll get to see it.
This is now Christmas Eve for me, and I am just giddy as I was when I was 7 years old before I learned that Santa wasn't real.
What?
On that note, get out and shoot.